I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. After a week of UK-US-EU armed slaughter in Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, Iran, Gaza and Jerusalem, the chief sponsor of Israeli terror, Genocide Joe, had to call off his scheduled meetings in US-occupied Germany today, intended to give away ever more money to Ukraine's dictator Zelensky. Americans devastated by Hurricane Milton may wonder why they are spending billions of dollars financing tens of thousands of its soldiers to be in Germany in the first place. They may yet wonder why billions are spent on Netanyahu for genocide here in the Middle East when tens of millions need federal aid back home to survive. The chaos and death sown by a demented Biden and so-called Holocaust Harris administration could now force billions to suffer the consequences of the destabilizing of world trade through the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. It was one of the subjects on the table for the Iran-Saudi Arabia meeting in Riyadh on Wednesday. And as the NATO nation-sponsored genocide continues, what exactly is the scale of psychosis in nuclear-armed Israel? Joining me now from Ramallah is international lawyer Dr. Diana Buttu, who has negotiated for Palestine at international courts. She has held fellowships at Harvard and Stanford, both subject to a draconian crushing of student revolts over the US-armed Gaza genocide. Dr. Buttu, thanks so much for coming on. You've seen how the media this week in NATO nations covered the October 7th attacks, privileging European-origin Zionists over Palestinians. What's it been like to witness this one-year anniversary from Israel?
It's been a complete onslaught. Constant images of their own victimization without any recognition whatsoever of the genocide that is being perpetrated by Israel, by Israelis against Palestinians, or of the ongoing attacks in Lebanon, in Syria, in Yemen, and so on. It's been just just inwardly focused on their own pain with no recognition of anything that they have done to Palestinians. It's incredible to watch because they have such blinders on, primarily because this has been the ethos of the Zionist state, is to dehumanize Palestinians and to elevate themselves. So their pain, their victimization is supreme, and nobody else can ever be a victim.
And that pain clearly travels to the capitals of Western Europe and, of course, Washington, to Biden and Blinken and the rest of them. Genocide Joe, backed by Holocaust Harris, said that the strikes on Beirut, and there's been a lot of killing in Lebanon, we should remember, and millions displaced. The killing of resistance leader Hassan Nasrallah was a measure of justice. I mean, you're an international jurist. Clear that the support is coming from NATO countries for the genocide.
Oh, absolutely. 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 I think we do a huge disservice if we somehow think that this is just Israel. This is definitely, most definitely being pushed on by the United States. It's been fueled by it. It's been funded by it. It's been diplomatically supported by it. And even the terminology, the wording, you know, on the one hand, Israel claims to have such precise weaponry. And yet on the other hand, alongside killing Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, they also killed at least 300 other Lebanese. And so those 300 victims get somehow erased or be declared as collateral damage. And of course, that's not the way that international law works. You can only be targeted if you are an actual combatant. And yet in the case of Israel, because Israel deems anybody who is resisting their military rule as somehow a combatant, whether that person is a child, a baby, a person who's elderly, who's weak, all of these people are fair game or collateral damage in Israel's eyes.
But maybe things may change as the carnage in Florida from Hurricane Milton appears on the scene to make Americans wonder about why billions are being sent. The Americans seemed almost proud this week at the State Department not to be able to answer whether it was $18.9 billion or so that was given from U.S. public money to Netanyahu instead of the poor of the United States.
This is precisely the problem. I'm not so sure that the Americans are going to wake up and realize that the reason that they don't have health care, the reason that there are, is such a homelessness crisis, the reason that they can't deal with these natural disasters is because of the money that they give to Israel. When you explain it, it resonates. But the U.S. government, alongside the Israel lobby, do such a great job of trying to hide these statistics and hide these facts from Americans to make it look as though somehow the interests in the Middle East, in other words, the killing of children, particularly Palestinian children, is something that is absolutely necessary rather than being able to provide themselves with housing, with healthcare, and with the ability to address things like these disasters.
Having said that, with the polls, in fairness, they do show, some of them, that the people of the United States support Palestine, unlike the candidates in November. Actually, I do want to get to what's actually happening there on the ground. But, I mean, given that you had fellowships at Ivy League schools, what do you think this next semester, too frightened will be the students, given the tear gas and armed security on the campuses that you were a fellow at in the United States?
Yes, and it's not just those campuses, it's campuses across the United States. What was very interesting was that in the aftermath of October 7th, all of these campuses came out very quickly and condemned October 7th and the actions of October 7th. And then when it became clear that Israel is committing genocide, this isn't just my words, these are the words of international human rights organizations. It's the words of the ICJ saying that there is a plausible case for genocide. Suddenly, these same universities decided that they had to take a hands-off approach and say nothing when it comes to Palestinians. At the same time, while we saw this wave of protests and of encampments across U.S. universities, and not just in the U.S., it's actually across the world, over the summer, these same universities have taken measures to crack down on any sort of protest. That includes everything from banning organizations like Students for Justice in Palestine. It includes making sure that students are not allowed to stage any protests on the campus. And so when you think about the ways in which, and of course, calling the police and so on. And so if you think about what a U.S. campus is supposed to be, that's supposed to be the space for free ideas, for free speech. And yet it's free speech when it comes to one side. And then when it comes to another side, you are not whatsoever allowed to exercise your right to protest or even free speech. And let's be clear, these students are not just demanding the right to protest, but they're saying that their universities are complicit because they are. They have not divested from Israel and they want to see some more transparency. And instead, we see that the university has enacted measures to make it even more opaque so that people cannot see exactly where the tens of thousands of dollars in tuition fees are actually going.
Well, at least so far, there hasn't been a revival of the fatalities like Kent State in the Vietnam War, of course. But where you are in the heart of things, as it were, comedians are making jokes calling for the extermination of all Arabs, and there are narratives, I mean, what Bella Hadid and Dua Lipa and probably, I don't know, Roger Waters and Susan Sarandon, they should be killed. People just laugh about that as jokes in where you are in Palestine or in occupied Palestine.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and it's worse than that. It's for quite some time, the top 10 songs that were on the Israeli hits were at least three of them were ones that called for a genocide. The most viewed video on YouTube, the most YouTube video that is Israeli, is one that openly calls for genocide. The lyrics will astonish you. We have not only comedians making fun of Palestinians, but we have commentators who say that there should have been more than 100,000 dead. Commentators who say that it's okay to rape Palestinians. In fact, that they should be raping them. We have commentators who also say that it's okay to torture Palestinians. We see on the nightly news TikTok stars. And who are these TikTok stars other than Israeli soldiers who are blowing up Palestinian houses, who are dedicating the blowing up of houses to their children or to their spouses, who do a save the date by spraying Save the Date inside a Palestinian house before blowing it up, to others where they were proudly blowing up universities, mosques, you name it. And so there is a real sense of genocide fever here, a genocide fever that is being pushed and fueled not only by the government, but also by the Israeli media, with nobody saying to them, whoa, where are we going? What are we doing? Let's put the brakes on this. And the astonishing thing is that this was a state that was presumably born of the Holocaust. And yet we see that while they talk about the lessons of the Holocaust, this idea of never again is only applicable to them. It's not at all applicable to any other group, and certainly not applicable to the actions that they are perpetrating against Palestinians.
And of course, the Biden-Harris administration tried to ban TikTok to prevent Americans perhaps from seeing some of those videos. But in fairness to the Israeli press, it has in some cases been far better than the propaganda media of BBC and Sky and CNN, in the sense that they investigated October the 7th to destroy the narratives of rape and babies being beheaded and cooked in ovens.
Yes, they have. They've done a little bit of a job, but they have not taken it fully to task. And at the same time, while they've done these investigative pieces, these same news outlets are the same outlets that are saying that it's okay to bomb Lebanon. It's okay to assassinate Palestinian leaders. It's okay to assassinate Lebanese leaders, and so on. And so it's quite a mixed bag. But to get to your point about Western corporate media, you're absolutely right. I don't think that this genocide would have been possible for the full year that we've now seen it without the assistance of the Western corporate media. For example, during the first 10 days of the genocide, we saw that Israel attacked the Baptist hospital. And rather than journalists questioning the legality of attacking the Baptist hospital in Gaza, they instead somehow blamed it on Palestinians, and suddenly everybody became an expert on crater sizes. That attack on the Baptist hospital then led to the attack on 32 of the 36 hospitals that exist in Gaza. And what we're seeing this week alone is that the Israelis have issued evacuation orders for the entire northern part of the Gaza Strip, and in particular, the hospitals in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. All of that would not have been possible had there been actual questioning of Israel's tactics and its motives, rather than simply being stenographers and parrots for whatever it is that the Israeli army has been saying.
Dr. Diana Bhutu, I'll stop you there. More from the lawyer and former negotiator for the Palestinian Liberation Organization after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with lawyer and former negotiator for the Palestinian Liberation Organization, Dr. Diana Bhutu. Dr. Bhutu, in part one, you were talking about how Western narratives have aided complicity and everything else with the genocide. But I understand you have spoken to some who have been tortured by British, American, EU armed soldiers. Tell me about that. Eating maggots, offers of euthanizing anesthesia?
I don't even know where to begin. Yes, I have spoken to a number of Palestinians who've been held hostage, literally held hostage by the Israeli army. And their conditions are horrendous. Everything from folding their arms and keeping them shackled for 24 hours a day in fetal position, being forced to sleep on the ground without any mattress, being blindfolded, their hands tied so badly that in some cases they had their hands amputated, and amputated, by the way, without any anesthesia. In some cases, being forced to eat food that has maggots in it, not being able to take a shower for 50 days on end, being given the equivalent of less than one cup of water to drink on a daily basis, not being able to go to the bathroom except at specific times during the day, to then being tortured even further beaten for not being able to stand, even though their legs are shackled, beaten for speaking, beaten for not speaking. And then, of course, people who have also described horrendous, horrendous, horrendous stories of rape. These are stories that nobody should be, these are experiences that nobody should be experiencing and nobody should be having to live through. And yet it's become so commonplace inside Israel that the only times that we've seen protests was not protests to stop these rapes or to stop the torture, but protests in favor of these rapes and in favor of this torture. It's horrifying, and something must be done to stop it.
I know you're an international lawyer, and I don't know on this show whether we talk that much about the ICC and ICJ. Given the scale of the genocide, you're talking about torture there, redolent, I suppose, of Abu Ghraib and British torture in Ireland, but on a much more bigger scale. Karim Khan was on this show. He's the head of the ICC. Apparently, he was threatened by someone, forces, I think he was saying. What do you make of those international institutions? Is it not time to realise that, as a lot of people in the Global South already did, that they're all a load of rubbish? There's no point in the ICC and ICJ, apart from jogging along a little bit the agenda in some elements of bourgeois opinion in NATO nations.
You know, I vacillate between thinking that there is zero utility to some utility. And the reason that I vacillate between the two is, on the one hand, I've seen that the International Criminal Court is really just a criminal court to go after African leaders and Putin. So far, this is the longest period to issue an arrest warrant. Mr. Karim Khan came out at the end of May the 20th, to be exact, saying that he was going to issue arrest warrants. He was seeking arrest warrants. And now we are in middle of October, and there still are no arrest warrants that have been issued. This is the longest period ever for arrest warrants not to be issued. So on the one hand, I say, what's the utility of these when we see that the greatest offenders of international law are those that are being propped up by other nations? And on the other hand, I say to myself, we must continue to use these tools and bring the receipts. In other words, we must continue to do what we do to try to hold them accountable. And whether that means pushing for boycotts, pushing for divestment, pushing for sanctions, pushing for accountability, pushing so that Israel and Israelis are made to feel that they cannot continue with this genocide, then we must do so. And the ICC and the ICJ, these two international institutions, are simply one tool. They are not the only tool. And so there's simple things like, you know, we must continue to go after Israeli soldiers and let them be known that they're not welcome in countries where they actually believe in human rights, because there are so many soldiers who are out there.
Amos Hochstein, I think the Biden-Harris envoy, is a former IDF soldier, isn't he? And that's the Middle East envoy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But he's not the only one. For example, there are so many videos of these soldiers who have been quite open about their brutality when it comes to Palestinians. They broadcast on, they TikTok them. We need to make sure that these soldiers are held to account, because I don't want to live in a world where there is no accountability for these mass atrocities. And the fact that we've seen this genocide surpass a year now, it just shows you not only how weak these institutions are, how controlled these institutions are, but also that there are so many other ways that we must continue to push to hold Israel accountable.
It's been a trope on NATO nation propaganda media to say, do you condemn Hamas and whatever resistance group it is, whatever alternative it is? What is the measure of deterrence provided by those resistance groups that obviously don't seek that kind of way of trying to see restitution and justice? I mean, if it wasn't for Iran, Yemen, Syria, Iraq increasingly, would they have exterminated every Palestinian in Gaza by now?
I think that it's also a question of what's going on in Gaza itself. I think the Israelis are quite surprised that this genocide has gone on for over a year with there still some resistance. I mean, that I think has been very surprising to the vast majority of Israelis, including those within the Israeli army. Just as they were surprised by October the 7th and how deep in and how bad their systems were, their so-called defense systems were, they've also been surprised at the level of resistance to Israeli military rule. The problem, of course, when it comes to Israel is that it's not only backed by the United States and by Western powers, but they've also developed a mindset that somehow they can be the agents of change. And so you hear very openly now on Israeli streets, people talking about the need to have regime change in Iran as though it's somehow Israel's role to be choosing leaders around the world. They're also very openly talking about regime change in Lebanon, regime change in Syria. Soon they'll be talking about regime change in Jordan. They've already spoken about who the next leaders cannot be when it comes to Gaza. So on the one hand, they're very surprised by the level of resistance. At the same time, they have this level of arrogance that still allows them to think and believe that they have the ability to choose who the next leaders are in this region.
And of course, while, as I say, genocide, Joe, Holocaust, Harris, for the rest of their lives, they will be known for having presided over this. Donald Trump, apparently, was in a call with Netanyahu, ahead of the Biden-Netanyahu call this week, with Lindsey Graham, who advocates for genocide, on the same call. Trump, of course, funded by the widow of the man who used to fund Netanyahu, the Adelson family, who funds the Trump campaign, $100 million, Miriam Adelson, and it was her dead husband who used to fund Netanyahu. Nothing good is going to come from the US political scene in November as regards what goes on in this region?
Precisely. Look, if there's been one consistent, it's that whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, Palestinians are the ones who pay the price. It doesn't matter whether it's a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. And I can give you some examples of how that has played out. Look, under President Trump, I don't want to say, you know, I think people are mistaken if they somehow think that he's an anti-war president. He's not. But under President Trump, we saw everything from the attempt to dismantle UNRWA, the attempt to dismantle the Palestinian Authority, the closure of the office in Washington, D.C., the transfer of the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. We saw the closing down of
all those things to actual genocide in Gaza on this scale.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what I was about to say, when you look at what Biden did, Biden didn't reverse any of those things except to reverse the money parts of it. He didn't reopen, he didn't move the embassy, he didn't reopen the consulate, he did none of those things, and he presided over a genocide. If Trump is elected, what's he going to do? He's going to continue the exact same policies as Biden had done in the past. And if Harris is elected, what's she going to do? The exact same thing. The number one policy for the United States is to keep this colonial entity in place, being Israel. It's a military base, it's a large military base, to keep it in place, and they don't give a damn about Palestinian lives, and as long as that military base remains. And this is why you see so much funding going to Israel as opposed to going to the United States and to the coffers of the United States.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see, of course. I mean, make America great again, make Israel great again. There are already jibes coming from Trump supporters in his campaign. So just finally, how long do you think it will take to erase this sickness of Israeli Zionism?
It's hard to say. You know, it's really hard to say. I think that as long as we continue to see U.S. funding continue, and it will continue for quite some time, then Israel and Israelis will continue to have the same mindset. At the same time, I think it's important for people to understand that there are a number of Israelis who are waking up and realizing that they will forever be living by the sword because of the policies that this state has taken on over the course of the past 76 years. It's taken far too long for them to realize it, but they're now beginning to open their eyes and see that there is no future, there is no horizon for this idea of a colonial entity in the middle of the Middle East. So it's taken far too long, but some of them are waking up to this reality. The other reality that they're waking up to is there's always been an equation that Israel has operated on, two of them. The first is that what can't be achieved by force can only be achieved by more force, i.e. living by the sword. And the second one is that the only way that Israelis can remain safe is if the Palestinians are made unsafe. And even then, some are starting to realize that both of those two ways of thinking are not sustainable in the long term. And so we are seeing people leave. We are seeing that the Israeli economy is collapsing. We are seeing that it's taking a lot more to prop up this entity. And it's really just going to be a question of time before people come together and say, we want to live as equals, not as people who are superior and inferior, but actually as equals. I'm not holding my breath at this point in time. That's only going to come if there's external pressure, and I just don't see it right now. But I do think that it will eventually come.
Dr. Diana Buttu, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those surviving the UK-US-EU armed violence here in the Middle East. We'll be back on Monday with former Nigerian government minister Femi Fani-Kayode. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.